That was a question. That wasn't.
The way Alexander taught that Christ was divine and always existed with the Father eternally. Arius taught that Christ was the most important of the created beings, but was not pre-existent with the Father.
Okay. And this is a debate that would go on and carry on into another council as well. I ask you a question. Who holds the view? I get that thing out of there. I'll turn it off.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
What was the scriptural basis for Harris's argument? And what I'm getting at is this. Jehovah's Witnesses have the eternal argument, and part of their basis goes out of John, the first chapter. They try to say, you know, where he was a God or something like that.
Yeah.
Is there any way similar to what the Witnesses argue today? Is it a totally different?
Yeah, I think it's different. And the interesting thing about it, I don't think it's a scriptural argument.
I'm sorry?
I don't think it's a scriptural. I don't think its basis was scriptural. Who do we talk about so much? Well, let me rephrase that. He may have used scriptures to make his argument. But who do we talk about the philosophy that was around? And spend so much time on. What philosophy was it? Gnosticism. Gnosticism held this view. Matter's evil. Spirit's good. Can't have a mix of the two. That philosophy, that's the backdrop for these kinds of debates that were going on. And with Arius, that would be one of the pieces of it, that he was steeped in that kind of philosophy of the day. And so whatever his interpretation was, to whatever extent he used the Bible to make that interpretation, it was in a backdrop of that philosophy. And you see that throughout. And it doesn't stop, although it's not as... it doesn't infiltrate the church members as much openly as in the latter centuries, but that philosophy carries through it. In the latter centuries, you see it. Okay, and Mike's already alluded to answer the second one. Of course, the JWs believe that today. Universalists hold that view as well. I mean, Unitarians, excuse me. Number five. Three ways was the Council of Nicaea especially significant? Well, that's an interesting word. That's meant to be specific. I think I probably meant specifically as opposed to especially, which I didn't spell in the right anyway. You got seven. There's eight.
Creates protest of fellowship.
Okay. Sorry, I'll say it again.
Creates protest.
What else? Yeah. And of course, it was the first general council, big council as well. Seven. There were four parties that show up in the Council of Constantinople. Who were they? And just briefly, what do they believe? And this is going to carry on. Another one of those that just carries on, the arguments for several hundred years.
Were they the ones that just wanted to say that Mary was the bearer of God? God bearer, or something like that?
That's going to come later.
Christ was the same substance with the Father, similar substance with the Father, like the Father, or not like the Father.
Yeah, so you had, which one would you like to? Which view would you like to have? There's a party for any view, okay? And so this debate about substance, I don't know whether it was Rocky or Todd. Somebody brought up the point that it's nice to use Bible words and Bible meanings, and these are not Bible words and Bible meanings. Yeah, that's what I said. These are not Bible words and Bible meanings.
Okay, so that's true. You said put it in plain English. I'm like, well, I mean,
They I don't know what they, you know, depending on who's doing the talking, they take a different, you know, they might have a different take on substance. You might think, you know, I think Rocky said essence was one of the definitions. Being is another sort of meaning. You may take that to, they may have taken it to mean spiritual, you know, that substance, whatever the spiritual substance is, what their essence is, what their, that's about the best I can do with it. I mean, it was a debate around trying to rationalize what scriptures did, the way scriptures presented God and Christ with their understanding of the world and philosophy and context and culture they were in. The other thing we see in Constantinople, the Macedonian bishops, we didn't spend a lot of time on this, but what was their view? They had another aspect of this. Okay, Holy Spirit's not divine. And that'll come up again in a later time. What view of the authority of the Roman bishop did this council take? Anybody get that one? Okay, he got honor, and interesting that he was viewing honor relative to Constantinople, but it's not the honor in the sense of being a universal bishop. It's just he just got us. Sorry. And they were, they really were not supposed to get outside of that, and they'll reinforce that even at a later council. But this one was more just from the standpoint of providing honor but not authority, is the way I describe it. And they'll backtrack. And this is something that's going to go on throughout these councils. And the reason I wanted to bring that up is, of course, we know where it ends up, and that is Rome is in authority. The Bishop of Rome. Okay, here's our friend Nestorius and Cyril. Question 12. Just basically, what were their views? Okay, what did Nestorius do?
That's the one
that said that.
Named Mary.
God-bearer. He was against using that term. Because he downplayed the humanity of Christ. He was opposed by Cyril, who said was looking at it from the standpoint of being against Nestorius and trying to make sure that one, the term was used, but also that that Jesus' divinity was not downplayed in favor of humanity. And so that debate started going on, and it was during this time also. This one or maybe the next one, I get confused. If there got to be this discussion around, or somebody brought out, well, you know, how is it with divine and human? How are these natures melded? How do they come together? And so that gets to be the major controversy of the next few councils. What kind of attitude? In fact, just start with this. What kind of approach did the Eastern Church take toward the incarnation of Christ? I hope you could find, you know, I hope you get the answer out of that. I just started talking about it a moment ago. You got divine and humanity, human. These two natures they were debating around Christ. And what kind of attitude was being taken by the Eastern Church? What were they doing with those? I know this is one of those bad questions. Speculating about how this could be. Remember me saying, talking about that? They were trying to rationalize and deal with the details. Well, how could this be? How could man, or humanity, and divinity be in the same person? And the question I have for class, what does Deuteronomy 29:29 say? Yeah, and the revealed things to us. And this was part of the problem. They were dealing, as we've already seen, this has been true all that throughout, as they've been dealing with some of these things, to try to rationalize, harmonize their whatever scriptural basis they have with their philosophical underpinnings. They educated the world trying to make something out of this, and this would continue to plague these folks for hundreds of years to come. Okay.
And I was thinking about Paul said to Timothy, he said, guard what has been entrusted to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of read that as guard what has been entrusted. Guard what has been entrusted. That's it. I'm trying to make this distinction. The things that you've been given, guard them. But also there's that idea of there have been some things that have been given to you, and then there's some other things that haven't been. And so avoiding worldly and empty chatter and your closing arguments of what is falsely going on. She's talking about things you don't have any idea about. Arguing about them and making words like similar and substance and like. And,
right.
You know, things that we just don't. The only way you can make a distinction is by human arguments.
There is statement talking about Timothy, a statement made in 2 Timothy 2:23, but refuse foolish and ignorant speculations, knowing they produce quarrels. And I think about these folks, and very clearly there was a lot of that going on for years to come, and it still goes on. Okay, lesson 7.
But to take some of the positions, you know, is not a matter of speculation. I'm sure there's a lot of speculation of what they did, but the end results of those speculations are not a speculative matter. If Christ is divine or is not, that's not speculative.
No.
And so that's the, you know, where Paul would have to take a stand.
Sure.
And
there are the speculative part of it was how could that be?
Yeah.
That's where the speculation was, and so they tried to explain it in a myriad of ways, and. That's what, you know, got him in trouble and resulted in these councils. But that's right. I mean, Jesus is God. Jesus is human. That's not, you know, the Bible teaches that. But what they were trying to do is understand, well, how can that be? And rationalize it away. Or rationalize and harmonize it. Okay. Lesson 7. We've had 3 councils. We're getting into the 4th. And as I started out in the introduction, this very point, the nature of Christ, this discussion became, you can argue, and it may have gone back even another council. I just picked up on mainly the main focus of the Ephesus council, where it started to break water, and it carries on. It was the major controversies of the next 3 councils. It would go on into the 3rd Constantinople. Third Council of Constantinople in 680. They'd still be having these debates. Recall that Theodosius II called the Council of Ephesus. He really favored, going into that, the guy that lost Nestorius. And so he eventually gets to the point where at that time, he acquiesced to the decision. The favored Cyril's argument that Christ was both human and divine. And, of course, that council became the 3rd ecumenical council as well. That Nestorius was sent off after that to exile and ended up dying in around 450. At the end of Lesson 6, there's actually a... I'm not going to read it, but I called it Results of the Council. And the second point under that is John of Antioch in 433 sent this compromise. What that is following the actual meeting, Theodosius had, in effect, lost his, you know, his guy. And so he, being emperor, to force this, he had the 2 parties, the Syrians and the Alexandrians, get together and come to a better understanding. And so the product of that is what I showed under an excerpt of the creed. It's really not a creed per se. It was a formula of union, they called it. And that's what they produced to try to reconcile these two positions that they had that were being argued. And so that happened within a couple of years of the Ephesus Council. And then as part of that agreement, whereas Nestorius had been exiled, and the Syrians were wanting to get him back, and Cyril had these 12 anathemas I mentioned, but we didn't spend any time on, against Nestorius. They'd kind of dropped their two demands, and so they reached a compromise, and that's what that union represents, that statement represents. But following that, you have what's typically the case, that is, those who reached the compromise were happy, but the ones on either end, it's kind of like the Democratic base and the Republican base, they're both unhappy when you get out into the true believers. So this problem doesn't go away. What does go away are most of the characters who were involved in it at this time. And so in the 440 time period, everybody except a fellow by the name of Theodoret, I suppose. Say it fast again.
Theodoret.
Yeah, Theodoret. Say it fast and you lose all the syllables. That's good. That's like I say Louisville. And so anyway, he was a protagonist in all of this, going back to the Council in Ephesus. And the other characters, John, who wrote this part of this 433 creed that or statement union that we looked at a while ago, he passed away. Leo ended up being Bishop of Rome, Leo I. There's a fellow by the name of Dioscorus who succeeded Cyril. And then another one, Flavian, who ended up being Patriarch of Constantinople. So they'll get involved. So this kind of baton passes to these characters. And like I say, Theodoret's the only one that's in the midst that was at Ephesus. And so the dispute pops up again. And a new guy comes on the scene, beyond these fellows, and a fellow named Eucodus. Eucodus was a monk. And he was attacking what was sort of the orthodox view, which is two natures in one personality. And his view was that, he started promoting, was what was effectively a single nature. That is, something, there's only one nature. The human side of Christ was soaked up in, fact, he described it as like a drop of wine in the sea, was soaked up in the divinity of Jesus. And so there was no human side. It was just the divine side in a physical body. And so his philosophy, if you like, or his teachings became known as Monophysite, which is one word that follows means single nature. And so he started to talk about that elevated the whole issue in front of the church leaders. And so Theodosius calls another council, again in Ephesus. So this isn't the one we're going to, this isn't the Chalcedon yet, Chalcedon. This is an Ephesus council, and I consider it one of the ecumenical councils, even though it was widely supported. And Leo, who's now the Bishop of Rome, if you keep all these characters straight, Leo, the Bishop of Rome, sends, and this is really their first proactive activity in this whole controversy. He sends a statement over for these guys in Ephesus to approve. And, it's a statement that has to do with two natures after the union. And what happens, the bishop that has succeeded Cyril, Dioscorus, he takes over the council. And as a result of that, Leo's tome is just thrown out. I mean, he just rejected out of hand. And Eucodus comes back into favor. His teaching of Monophysite. Flavian, who is the bishop of Constantinople, he gets banned, gets gotten deposed of. This union the formula of union, with the two-nature doctrine, it gets rejected by this guy. And Theodoret is excommunicated. So it's kind of like, you know, you forget what went on in Ephesus, throw it all out, we're going back. And that was the outcome of that little gathering. In fact, Leo, they would become known as the robber, or they would become known as the robber band because of the nature of the way the thing was run, and it was really an attack on Constantinople is the way it was reviewed. And because Theodosius, being the kind of guy he was, he really, it wasn't any recourse to talk to him in the course of all this. So it waited until he died. His sister took over, and her husband, and they called this Council of Chalcedon. And so that's the sort of the background that gets you to the actual council itself. Theodoret's back in, you know, he's back in action. But at this stage, again, he's making an argument which will be taken by the crowd to appear to favor Nestorius, which, you know, this is it's sort of like Arius. Arius eventually morphs into a movement as opposed to an individual. Same thing with Nestorius. Whatever his view was, it sort of morphs into a belief, and it's associated with his name, but he's not, you know, he's nowhere to be seen anymore. In this case, what Theodoret was arguing was that Christ's body was the same essence as our own. He was human. The union of the two natures, divine and human, occurred in one person. Now, having said that, he really, when you start to, at least as I read people, when you try to understand what he was really trying to teach, it is not at all clear. He ended up favoring, and people took him to favor in this, because he did, in his case, although Nestorius was talking about trying to get away from the God-bearer because he thought that gave the wrong, took away from the humanity of Christ. Theodoret, because of his arguments, was trying to argue in such a way that people took him also to be trying to do that, even though that wasn't apparently what he was trying to do. But he refused to accept he really refused to accept the basic teachings of Nestorius, the specific teachings of Nestorius, and he defended them, and at the same time he ended up supporting the anathemas against Nestorius. So you tell me where he was. I really could never figure out quite where this guy was, and yet he was a protagonist throughout all of this. And you know, it struck me, just as an aside in reading about him and what all went on, that he, as well as others, were often driven by what they were arguing against as opposed to what they were arguing for. He was arguing in large part against another belief, and that is that was held by a guy that I mentioned in passing in one of our lessons, Apollinarius. And Apollinarius believed that it was impossible to have two natures in one person. And so when he says that's impossible, then Theodoret's arguing what is possible. And so they get into this debate, well, you know, he spends so much time arguing that it is possible that he gets associated with other people. So they're driven by what are they arguing against. And I bring that up, and you know, as confusing as that may be, just keep in mind, in our day, this is not unlike things that happen today. There are issues, I'll call them, that disturb the, quote, brotherhood. And the issues are oftentimes valid issues. What happens is there's so much time spent debating against whatever the issue is or against somebody that what happens is you lose sight of the balance that needs to be in play about other things that need to be either taught or other teaching the whole of the scriptures as opposed to focusing on only one part. And you can see it, and it's for good and valid things. And I think I may have mentioned this in the past. I've seen it happen in my lifetime in the I mean, if the issue was in the 50s and before, and I saw it in the 60s, that people were so much focused on an error, which was institutionalism, and spent a lot of energy focusing on that error, that it ended up being their whole mindset was to argue against error as opposed to also preaching, in the case of preachers, preaching things that would be beneficial to, and truth beyond that issue to others. Just as a brief aside, I was just reading an article about the conservative or the religious right this morning in Scanning, and they were talking about some guy that's, I think he was a Baptist preacher, but he got to the point where the issue was politics with him, evidently. He was preaching politics all the time, and it's one of these cases where he's a quote pastor, and the deacons got together and said, you need to stop preaching on political matters 52 weeks a year and bring in some other balance. And that's what can happen. And that, in a way, is what happened. In some ways, is what happened here. Anyway, back on track. Leo, who's been involved with this, been rejected by Discorus, ended up, as part of this council as well, sending a proposal to it. From a practical standpoint, and I gave you that in the lesson. And so that was his contribution to this. And so the council was held, and Leo's position would be incorporated in the council. It was a big council, biggest council that had been held to that date, or was ever held, I guess, at least seven. And it had a number of conclusions out of it. One, to take and bring the parties together as best they could. And I think it may be boring as I'll get out, but it may be instructional to see how they or what conclusion they reached around this particular controversy. They undid this robber band synod that it had before, where Leo had been thrown out. Of course, they got rid of excommunicated. Made him step down, deposed of his position, Dioscorus, who was the Patriarch of Alexandria. And they put together what was a composite definition. I'll just tell you what it consisted of. It consisted of the creeds of the 325 Council, the 381 Council, two letters of Cyril refuting Nestorius, Leo's tome, and a new confession compiled largely by Cyril, Leo, and the formula 433. So they take all this and, you know, kind of try to blend it. Here's the way it reads. Now, try to read this as it's written. You'll get lost. I get lost reading it. We all with one voice confess our Lord Jesus Christ, one and the same Son, at once complete in head and complete in man, truly God and truly man, consisting of a reasonable soul and body, of one substance with the Father as regards Godhead, of one substance as regards his manhood, like us in all things, apart from sin. Begotten of the Father before the ages as regards his Godhead, the same in the last days, for us and for our salvation, born from the Virgin Mary, the God-bearer, as regards his manhood. One and of the same Christ, Son, Lord, only begotten, to be acknowledged in two natures without confusion, without change, without division, or without separation, the distinction of natures being in no way abolished because of the union, but rather the characteristic property of each nature being preserved and coming together to form one person and one entity, not as if Christ were parted or divided into two persons. That's the creed you had to agree to. And I've read it several times, and I can pick out some of the things that were going on in the background, but it's in a lot of ways it ends up being gibberish, and that's. You have to imagine with the masses what they would ever make out of this. They wouldn't make anything out of it. And what they would happen, you can almost see one aspect of this, and that is the learned men who know about these kind of things and debate them start to be continue to be maybe even more so, strengthen their magnetism. You got to go to your bishop or your priest or whatever. for any leadership. I mean, if you have to interpret, look how much trouble they have interpreting the Bible. You're really going to have trouble interpreting the Bible.
Well,
yeah.
On page 48 at the top in the paragraph D, the statement is that Leo protested on getting
yes.
it wrong.
Yes.
Because it was political rather than contact with the apostles.
Yes.
The idea of contact with the apostles, is this that apostolic continuation?
Yeah.
Idea.
Yeah, Leo, you know, the Leo, you think Leo, I mean, Leo won this, quote unquote. He won. Okay, so you think he'd be happy. But he wasn't happy because of this very thing. He believed that Rome needed to be given preference. And he actually would, he was the guy that started going back and trying to tie back to Peter at this point in time. So we're in the late 400s, 450, mid 400s. He's starting to want to tie back to Peter for justifying Rome being over everybody else. So he wasn't happy at this stage because, in essence, he's been, you know, where Rome was sort of given honor in favor of Constantinople, this conference actually brings the two sort of in line with one another. And so that he starts trying to fall back on that. So it took him about 2 years before he'd even validate this conclusion in Rome. Okay. And it's politics. You know, it's ecclesiastical politics is all it is. And like all these canons we've talked, I mean, all these creeds that have come out, the councils, they didn't settle the controversy. And you ended up actually having, there's another thing going on in this time frame, by the way, just background, and I'm not sure just to what extent this is happening. But the West, the Eastern part of the empire is starting to be encroached upon by others. And eventually the Muslims are making the run at it. And so the politics of this, this Monophysite party ends up being Northern Africa, Egypt area, not Northern Africa. I guess Egypt's not considered Northern Africa, but it ends up being that part of the world. And so the emperors, because of the nature of the political things going on in the empire, they're trying to accommodate this view, even though that's not the conclusion of the council. So you got another subtext going on here. Okay, and eventually they would this party would separate. We'll see that in the next council. So that was the council of Chalcedon. And as is the case in all these, it didn't stop the issue. So the whole issue of nature again continues to be debated. This party of Monophysitism continues to fester and build. And while coming out of Constantinople, the bishops, you know, the party, the winners, if you like, condemned this teaching. In the course of having their discussions around it, various bishops would change sides, the emperors would change sides, and it went back and forth for a while. And ultimately, you had another council call, which was the second council of Constantinople, to deal with the issue. Yeah.
Isn't all of this debate that's going on here with that guy based so much of his quote historical facts on in the book, The Da Vinci Code?
Oh, I don't know. I never read the book.
Okay.
You got me on that. I didn't go see the movie either. So it could be.
I know that he. I haven't read it recently either. I've just gone off letters from him. One of the allegations he makes is that it was only about this time that
Oh, yeah. It is not uncommon to read that. I'm not sure. I don't remember who it was, which specific one of these councils are alluded to. I want to say Nicaea, but to say that the doctrine of the Trinity is an invention of the Roman Catholic Church in this time, the general time frame. That's common to hear that. I say common. I mean, you read people that don't want to believe in what the Bible has to say. And they'll attribute it to the Catholics. That's the Catholic's doctrine. And that's not, you know, that's not the case. Theodoret, there are three guys, Theodoret, Theodore, and Ibas, that wrote, in the interim here, wrote something that was called the Three Chapters. Each of these guys wrote a chapter of this. And the view of party that followed Eutychus was that these were Nestorians. And remember, Nestorians are bad. And so they started raising a ruckus about these guys. And as a result of that, they actually, there was some internal politics going on with the emperor and his wife. And the Monophysite party was calling for the excommunication of these three guys because they favored Nestorius. And the emperor's wife was, favored the Monophysites. And so they ended up calling another council, the one in Constantinople. And in part, well, in big part, this council was called to try to reconcile these two parties and was a favor, in effect, of trying to find favor with this party, this one-nature party, again, because of what was going on the world stage as much as the religious side of it. And that is the part of the world that they predominantly were in was under being lost from the empire. And so they needed the empire, the Western empire needed somebody in that area of the world that they could depend upon. So they, these things I read said they both persecuted and wooed the Monophysites. That said, this council was called. It did condemn these three guys as a, throwing out something that the Monophysites could be happy with. Then they said the conclusions of Chalcedon still stood, but it had to be interpreted by Cyril of Alexandria, what he taught. You can read the way they wrote that. They wrote it in such a way that it sounded like both. That was their attempt. That's why I say the human nature, found its individuality only in the person of the divine logos of the word. So they were trying to work both sides of the coin. They're trying to say there are two, but it's in one. And that's why nobody was happy. And the Monophysites, that didn't satisfy them. And it didn't satisfy this issue. It would come up again. The general issue would come up again. The orthodox view in the long run was still stick to the wall. The humanity and the Christ was both human and divine. And the Holy Spirit was God. And God the Father was God. So we hold three, hold the Trinity, what we call the Trinity today. But these parties are, this refinement that's going on, if you want to give it that kind of credit, is coming about because of these extreme arguments that are going on. The comment about the where I say they were unappeased and grew as a separate party, as I mentioned, that was largely because of the political environment at the time relative to the empire. Armenia, this Church of Armenia is in this party. They became this largely, I've read, to gain independence from the empire. So it went the other way around and from Constantinople. And then Georgia took up the other side of the issue so they could gain imperial aid and resist the Armenians. So you have these groups that are assuming or taking over certain beliefs so they can put themselves in a political position, basically, to do what they want to do, protect themselves or are you'll have more power wherever they think power comes from. Okay, so that's what was going on with those guys. The Third Council of Constantinople, if you can keep all this straight, continues this debate in a different fashion. There's a companion theory that came along. It's called monothelitism, and it has to do with one will. And the people who held this view taught that Christ had two natures, but only one personality and only one will. And so, and the argument was, if you had two wills, you'd be two people. And however they argue, as they argued that position, they were having trouble reconciling within the Orthodox view really the Orthodox are probably having trouble rationalizing or explaining their position, and so these monotheists started to have an impact. There was a party, I've given you a name, Sergius, and this is really by background. The council actually takes in 680. If you look at the controversy, one will or two, item number two, this is a little bit of background that things that had gone on before this back in the 630s to kind of explain some people. Sergius said that unity was found in one energy, whatever that was. Pope Honorius of Rome objected to this term, said Jesus had one will, and this one will belief became what I'd mentioned to you. And at this point in time, when the council's going to come about, Honorius has been succeeded by others, and one of them being Dominus, who is now the Bishop of Rome, and the successors had repudiated Honorius' views. And so the whole question was around this question of one will or two wills. The evidently, from historical data, it was a bitter strife like some of these were. A lot of arguments between the two, a lot of disagreements between the two sides. And the emperor himself took a position that favored the one will approach. And he sent everybody into exile, which emperors can do. And so in 678, there's a new emperor that comes on the throne. And he went into negotiations with Dominus, who's now the Bishop of Rome. And they concluded that they needed to have another council, a world council, they were going to settle this issue, which they've done so successfully on other issues. Again, the Muslims have overtaken the Monophysite provinces. And so the emperor, at this point, looks at it as important to get along with Rome. So he sort of, you know, he doesn't have much control out in the west anymore, out in the east anymore. So he's really has to try to strengthen his case in Rome itself. I've given you the basic conclusions. Once the council met, they amended the Chalcedon Creed, taught two natural wills for Christ, not opposed to each other. The human will following the divine will and its objection to it. Pope Honorius was condemned as heretical, and he was, of course, 50 years before this. The thing to take away from this is that we see Rome in this context taking with a Bishop of Rome having more of an impact. He's getting to be the power player, and that'll continue on. And was gaining independence from really the Rome. Of course, the other side, the Eastern Church, it was basically dominated to what extent they could. The other thing is to see how in the world, well, there's two things. See how in the world the politics, we've been seeing this all along, how politics play. But the other thing is the Pope is infallible. And here's a case today. Here's a case where this Pope was condemned by his successors. The Pope is not infallible by their view. And of course, that's going to change. I don't know how they explain this, by the way. I haven't gone back and tried to research that and think it was that important. Okay, we'll pick up, Lord willing, and finish up with the Second Council at Nicaea, and we will be through with councils, and then when it's all said and done, I expect every one of you to be able to remember every name and every position.
Right.
And we'll try to get into Augustine. If we get into Augustine, what you're going to start hearing is things that are much, well, even with the Catholic Council and all that, there's some of these things that are, some of these things that are, that kind of help you see what the Roman Catholics are today. And when we get into Augustine, we'll see both the Roman Catholic side of it, and we're starting to see the influence on doctrines that will become Protestant doctrines that you and I deal with day in, day out with others. So, Lord willing, we'll talk about that Wednesday. Thank you.